You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2010 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother John Warner on the subject, Judges. This class is titled, Postscripts.
I was just making the comment, this is no problem, this isn't chaos. You have to teach high school to really envision that. Now, today we've got to the tough part. I deliberately am beginning with the postscripts, that is, those which I think clearly are edited by somebody, probably Samuel, to indicate the two cities of the first two kings, Gibeah and Benjamin. I have counted, and my memory is probably failing, but it's fairly accurate to say that half of the times that Bethlehem is mentioned in our Bible are mentioned here in these two sections of the end of the book of Judges. Both of the Levites, one comes from Bethlehem and one passes through Bethlehem on his way to the hill country of Ephraim. You have a map in front of you, and if you're not used to maps, some people love maps. I always pour through them. I love to look, particularly a topo map that has elevation. I used to hike in the Sierras in my youth many years ago, and I just love envisioning the country and what was the best way to get to a certain lake. So please put up with a map if it's confusing to you. Hopefully we can clarify a couple of things because we are today going to be looking at the central south, if you will. And without the mic, let me just point out just very quickly where we will be going. The hill country, Gibeah is here, 3 miles north of Jerusalem, at the area where the airport is now above Jerusalem, just 3 miles to Gibeah. That's going to be the center. And all of the tribes are going to convene just to the north of that at Bethel to condemn Benjamin, to death, to murder every last man, woman, child of Benjamin. It's deliberately meant, I think we are deliberately meant, to see a comparison with Sodom and Gomorrah and the city of Gibeah. But I was mentioning to Brother John yesterday, I almost wonder, and this is just a sidelight, but I'd like you to think about it, whether the men of Israel shouldn't have been doing what Abraham did, and that is praying for the people instead of slaughtering them. Instead of making some foolish vows, and we'll talk about that later. But first of all, I want to talk about something, because when people, and I think it's very important in the book, when people talk about the period of the judges, they end up with a bad taste in their mouth, and it's probably chapters 19, 20, and 21 that do it for them. This is a period of 6 months in the middle of a 350-year period, where people acted wisely, righteously, violently, despitefully, just the way people always do throughout history. There is good and bad to be found in the period, and so I would just, in terms of some background, like to begin with the opening phrase. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And horror of horrors, every man did that which was right in his own eyes. What do we do today? Do we not do that which is right in our own eyes? Thanks be to God, He has called us out of darkness into His wonderful light. We have the Lord Jesus Christ as our King. And we hopefully act on that basis. But nobody is forcing us to bake for the monarchy, to serve the King. even to go to war. We have options. We do that which we feel is what the Lord Jesus wants us to do and act like. But in terms of doing that which is right in our own eyes, you know, we made a horrible thing out of that. It just means we're not coerced to do what is right in the king's eyes. Almost all commentators on the book of Judges say it is a bad time. Well, there are bad times in the book of Judges. But later on we'll take a look at a period that I think we may have mentioned yesterday, a period of 80 years of peace that is incredible in the history of mankind. Certainly in the history of Israel. Nelson's Bible commentary, his dictionary, is very typical. Without a human king to guide them, the people of Israel tended to rebel and fall into the worship of false gods time and time again. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Well, I think I disagree just in terms of making this the worst of times. It was not the best of times. It was not the worst of times. It was the time like any period in history. Whereas with a king, there was a really strong model. And King Saul said, "Kill the priests of the Lord because their hand is also with David." And so Doeg, the Edomite, turned and fell upon the priest, and he killed 85 persons who wore the linen ephod, and Nob, the city of the priest, he put to the sword both men and women and children and sucklings and oxen and asses and sheep. It's nice to be in the days of the king. Now, I'm not saying that the days of the king were all evil either. As we will find, there is good, there is bad, there is mediocrity. It's like any other time in history. However, I say that as a qualifier to what we're going to look at today, because today we are going to look at one of the most horrible times. Not just the city of Gibeah, not just the Benjamites, but the whole nation is corrupt, and we'll see evidence of that as we look at the 19th, 20th, and 21st chapters. I have some reticence doing this because I can't go through it too fast and I can't go too slow or we'll take 3 days. But we will try and get through this and then get on to the third postscript of the book of Judges, written by a young woman by the name of Ruth, which is absolutely wonderful and positive and encouraging. But before we do that, I want to remind you of a couple of things that I think are very positive about the period. It's a period when God raises up leadership. In between those periods, there is chaos, there is mayhem, there is murder, there is violence. But when God raises up, particularly the seven Yashar, the seven saviors, they are men of principle. I know we don't think of Samuel or Samson as having that kind of persuasion. I'm very thankful to what Christian said earlier. Samuel devoted his life to teaching, to helping, to counseling, as well as acting as the priest. Now why? He's not a priest. He's a Kohathite. And yet God accepts him as a priest because like Moses, he simply was a man raised up by God for that particular purpose, to guide the people, to help them. Who else does God raise up? He raises up prophets, doesn't he? "A prophet like unto me, the Lord God shall raise up," says Moses, "and you shall listen to him." Who else does God raise up? "I've raised up some of your sons for Nazarites," says Amos. God has raised up people in leadership roles, not because they were brilliant, not because they were brave, but because God raised them up. He knew their hearts. or their potential, I suppose I would say. The irony is, in these postscripts, we really don't know who the judge is. I will suggest right off the bat, if you're familiar with the chronology of the era, that it was in the latter period of Othniel when this civil war took place. Doesn't mean anything to you, perhaps, if you haven't looked at the book recently, but Othniel was the first judge. He was the nephew of Caleb. And there was peace for 40 years, and I'm afraid toward the end of this period there was this chaotic section which we're going to look at right now. So if you would open to the 19th chapter, if you don't have it, you can listen to me mumble through some of it. But the 19th chapter of the book begins the second postscript very early in the time of the judges. In those days, when there was no king in Israel, a certain Levite who was sojourning in the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim. Now, at this time, we know that Ephraim is heavily wooded. In fact, one of the complaints that Ted and I were kind of smiling about last night is the Ephraimites and the Manassites were complaining, we don't have enough land. And the Lord, through Joshua, essentially says, well, then go make some land. Go cut down some trees. There's lots of territory. You don't have to look for a posh estate that's already developed. And God tells him to go make something of the territory that they've been given. We don't know where this was in the hill country of Ephraim, but I hope you understand that the hill country of Ephraim is beyond the actual territory of Ephraim. Because, for example, Deborah will find, God willing, probably Thursday, we talk about the triumvirate, the Deborah and Jael and Barak. Deborah was in the hill country of Ephraim, but she was at Bethel, which is a city which belongs to Benjamin. It simply means that mountainous area from Jerusalem on to the north at Gilboa. But now we hear something about this wonderful Levite. And remember I said, and I'm not being sarcastic, the Levites don't come out looking very good in the book of Judges. They've neglected the people. The people may have neglected them, but it is a period of tremendous chaos from that respect. He took to himself a concubine from Bethlehem, and there again is this connection, from Bethlehem in Judah. And his concubine became angry with him. And by the way, the Hebrew just simply says she played the harlot. That's literally what it means. So the concubine wasn't a nice lady anyway. But if anybody in the story really begins to stink, it is the Levite as we proceed to look at him. She went away from him and returned to her father's house at Bethlehem in Judah. And there were some 4 months she was there. And then her husband arose and went after her to speak kindly to her and to bring her back. And you never hear another or a kind word that he speaks to her. That's perhaps the supreme irony. He simply wants her back. He's tired of home cooking. And he went along with his servant and a couple of asses. And by the way, that tells you that the man was not poverty-stricken. Don't feel sorry for the Levites that they've been deprived of their tithe. They may have, but they all seem to have a way of squeezing out a few shekels. If you have a couple of donkeys, you have a couple of cars in today's vernacular. He takes his servant with him and he goes to Bethlehem. And he came to her father's house, and when the girl's father saw him, he with joy went out to meet him. And now, you'll excuse me if I interpret this rather loosely, for the next 5 days they're drunk with their feet up on the sofa watching the telly. That's, I think, what we're meant to understand. Oh, stay another day and have a little something to eat. And they're popping bagels and drinking beer and whatever. Now, you think that's funny, but after a while you begin to realize she's in the kitchen cooking and these guys are out. It's the simplest way I can say they're having a great time. They're a bunch of bums. Or a couple of bums. So it goes on for 4 days, and then the fifth day, verse 8. And on the fifth day, he rose up early in the morning to depart. Good for him. He finally got sober, and he said, yeah, I really got to get home and feed the animals. And the girl's father said, strengthen your heart. You know, just tarry until the day, you know, the sun goes down, it gets a little cooler. And so they ate, both of them. And you might add, they probably had a few drinks as well. And when the man and his concubine and his servant rose up to depart, his father-in-law, the girl's father, said to him, behold, now the day's already shot. Pray, stay all night. Behold, the day draws to its close. Lodge here, let your heart be merry. And that's synonymous with have another drink. Tomorrow you can rise up early in the morning and be on your way. But the man would not spend the night, so he rose up and departed 5 o'clock in the evening when he couldn't possibly make it back to his home. He had with him a couple of saddle asses, and his concubine was with him. And when they were near Jebus, or Jerusalem, the city of the Jebusites, the day was far spent, and the servant wisely said to his master, come now and let us turn aside to the city of the Jebusites. Remember, there were lions, literally lions, in the hill country in those days, and you didn't want to camp out unless it was an emergency. So here's the city of the Jebusites. Yes, Marco. Yes. She's probably coerced. She's probably expelled from Dad's house. But for whatever reason, she agrees to go with him. Yes. Okay. Yes, thank you. It's the same concubine. Come now and let's turn aside to the city of the Jebusites. And his master said to him, we will not turn aside to the city of Gentiles, foreigners, aliens, who don't belong to the people of Israel. We'll pass on to Gibeah, just 3 miles more. No problem. Come, let us draw near to one of these places and spend the night at Gibeah or at Ramah, which is, again, just another couple of miles to the north of Gibeah. So they passed on, they went on their way, and the sun went down on them, and I think that's a very powerful expression. The sun went down on them in Gibeah. It's almost as though it's a finality. Its darkness has come upon the land. They turned aside to go in there and spend the night in Gibeah, and they went in and sat down in the open square of the city, for no man took him into his house to spend the night. And you'll be familiar that there is an old man who is not from the city who invites them in. He's actually from the hill country, perhaps knows people that this Levite knows. At any rate, he was the only one who invited them in. He is a sojourner himself. And skipping ahead to the 18th verse, he says, we are passing from Bethlehem in Judah to the remote parts of the hill country of Ephraim, from which I come. I went to Bethlehem in Judah, I'm going to the home, and nobody takes me into his house. And he's right, even today, even in a poor home, an Arab home, you will be welcome. You may only have some nasty coffee and bread, but you are welcome to spend the night. And so this would be a tragedy for nobody to welcome him in from the square. He says, well, we have strong provender. We've got lots of things with us. We got bread and wine for me and your maidservant. I think he's talking about his daughter. He never talks about his concubine. The only thing he does is throw her out the door. And the old man said, well, peace be to you. I will care for all your wants, only don't spend the night in this square. So he brought him in the house, and you'll remember that as they were making their hearts merry again the fifth day, Behold, the men of the city, base fellows, beset the house round about, beating on the door. And they said to the old man, the master of the house, bring out the man who came into your house that we may have sex with him. That's what it says. And the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, no, my brethren, don't act so wickedly. Seeing that this man has come to my house, don't do this vile thing. Behold, here is my virgin daughter and his concubine. Let me bring them out to you now. Ravish them. Do whatever you want with them. Now, I can't read this without feeling horrible. It is very possible that the old man knew they would refuse because they were more interested in men than women, to be very candid. But we do know when the concubine is cast out, she is raped repeatedly, she is beaten to a pulp, and she dies in the morning. Now, what choice did the Levite have? He could have prayed fervently to God to deliver him, and I think God would have. He could have gone out himself and given up his life, or perhaps persuaded them otherwise. He had a number of choices. He chose to take his concubine and throw her to the wolves. Marco, I see your hand up again.
I'm sorry,
God. No problem.
The old man,
he's a sojourner in the city of Gibeah. He actually belongs in the hill country to the north.
How is it that he has a house there?
I don't know. Good question. How he has it, but he's renting. He's a short-term renter. Yes. I mean, seriously, that's a good question. I have no idea. Yes, Ray. That's a good point. And it is possible that he had a townhouse as well as a farm, and I don't know. But he certainly has his own place. You are familiar with what happens. The men in the square are certainly violent, homosexual. In fact, the comparison to Sodom is frightening. They abuse the woman. She does die sometime close to the morning. And now turning over to verse 27, and again I want to notice the harsh way this is presented to us. And her master rose up in the morning, and when he opened the doors of the house and went out to go on his way, he hadn't even thought evidently about his wife, and that's really what the concubine is. She might be a lowly wife, but she's a wife. Behold, there was his concubine lying at the door of the house with her hands on the threshold, and that's a very sad picture to even think about. And he said, well, get up and let's be going. That's what he said. And we're supposed to feel sorry for this guy? No, we're not. But there was no answer. And so he put her upon the ass, and the man rose up and went away to his home. And we know when he got home, he took his butcher's knife, where he butchered the animals, cut her into 12 pieces, and wrote some harsh letters and sent him off to the tribes. We got to do something about these bad guys. And I love Pogo's response. We have found the enemy and he is us. I mean, what happens to the old man that kindly took him in? Is he slaughtered with all of the Gibeites? I don't know. I think, actually, the old man might be the one who's writing this story. It's just a hunch. But at any rate, he is successful. Wonderful. All of Israel gets together and says, we've got to eliminate this tribe in Israel. What a wonderful solution. I have an infection in my finger, and I suggest we just cut it right here at the shoulder, and we will cure the problem. I'm serious. The men of Gibeah were rotten. So you kill all of the Benjamites, men, women, and children. What a wonderful solution. Well, let's go on to the 20th chapter. It doesn't get any better. all the people of Israel came from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, and the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah, the watchtower, which Christian has pointed out on the map is in the high country above Jerusalem, about 8 miles. Mizpah belongs to Benjamin. Benjamin at this time is forced, or they feel that they are forced, into the city of Gibeah, into that area to the south. The chiefs of the people of all of the tribes of Israel presented themselves in the assembly of the people of God, 400,000 men on foot that drew the sword. Notice the numbers, because the numbers of those in Benjamin are fewer than 27,000. So wonderful. 400,000 to 27,000. That should last about an hour, and we will have obliterated everybody in Benjamin. But those are the men, but they insist upon killing everybody. But we know it doesn't work like that. And that, I think, is one of the wonderful stories that we're told here, that if we live in glass houses, we shouldn't start throwing rocks. Because you remember, for 2 days, it's an absolute disaster. As I remember, at the top of my head, and I'm somewhere within the number, 40,000 die going against Benjamin. And as far as I can tell, there are very few of Benjamin that die. Very, very few. And the lesson we can learn from that, and it's one that Matt always tells me, okay, you've given me a lot of history. Now, what does this mean to me? And I think it means something like this. Judging others produces division and self-justification. It wasn't that Gibeah wasn't rotten, or at least part of Gibeah. I'm not sure the whole city was as rotten as these men. But by judging them so harshly and condemning them and self-justification, the Lord turns around and really points the finger at those who come up to condemn Benjamin to obliteration. Now, yes, we can say, well, Benjamin was a tremendous fighting force. They are continually a tremendous fighting force. They have 600 experts who can throw superbly a sling with their left hand. And remember, left-handedness, if you've ever... My son's left-handed. They're vicious at ping pong. But they, seriously, were obviously expert fighters as well, and that was their reputation for a number of years. Now, what they do, and we're not told about that in any detail until later, is they make a couple of rash vows. Very, very rash vows. We are going to eliminate a tribe, they've decided. God has made the 12 sons of Jacob. God has created them to be a group together. And they have independently decided to eliminate that which is God has made. It was a tremendously rash vow, in my opinion. And not only that, they've said, we'll never, because we know some of these guys will escape, they're pretty clever, we will never, all of us, vow to give our daughters to Benjamin. Essentially saying, if anybody survives, they're going to have to go off to another country anyway. We're going to eliminate Benjamin. We agree. Now, the question I want to ask, and this is a harsh one, where is Phinehas? Where is Phinehas? Phinehas is that great leader who killed or stemmed the Midianite tide, the corruption. He's honored by Moses. He's honored by the one that's called Malachi. He's honored by God. And yet I wonder whether he doesn't have the general's mentality. The solution is to kill them all. I wonder whether General MacArthur and General McChrystal are not examples of great generals, but poor diplomats. See, the reason I say this is Phinehas is the high priest at this time. If you don't realize, this is his only a short period, probably less than 60 years after the end of the land, somewhere around that period. Phinehas should be the leader of the people. He's the wonderful one who is praised by Moses as saving this Midianite, this insidious set up by Balaam. He does a wonderful job. But as we used to say, the cream rises to the top and it sours. Now, I'm hesitant to say that Phinehas is a bad guy. I don't think I have any right to say that. But somewhere he was asleep at the switch. He's responsible. When these foolish vows are made, he should be standing aside. Before they go to battle, he should lead them in prayer. We're told that from Deuteronomy. He should actually lead the battle. He has some responsibility into this foolish action that is taken by the 12 tribes. And if you'll turn quickly to the very end, just keep your finger there, to the very end of the book of Joshua, we'll find when Eleazar, verse 33, last chapter, 24, when Eleazar, the son of Aaron, dies, they buried him at Gibeah, the town of Phinehas. Phinehas is the high priest. The town of Gibeah is not a holy city. It's not a city of priests. It's his city. Doesn't he bear some responsibility for the morality of it? Now, I love the NIV. They say, well, this isn't the same Gibeah. Nonsense. It is the same Gibeah. There are not two Gibeahs as far as I've ever been able to find. It's a nice way of saying it wasn't Moses' grandson. It was Moses' grandson. Again, I don't want to be rash. I don't think we're meant to evaluate people in the Old Testament and say who's good and who's bad. That becomes very foolish. But I think this is a weakness in terms of the whole structure. And it might tell us that Phinehas is wonderful for certain situations, but he's not a good diplomat. He's not a good spiritual leader of the people that he's responsible for. I will leave it at that, and we can have some violent discussions later. Now, I want to skip because I really want to get on to Ruth. How much time do I have? 2 minutes? 10. 10 or 12. We might make it. In day 3, of course, they do get the Gibeonites. They pull a trick move, which is done throughout history, where they proceed to look like they've been defeated. They retreat. And some circle around and enter the town and they slaughter everybody in it. There are a few who escape and get away. And so as we move on to the... let's move on to the 29th verse of the 20th chapter. 20th chapter, 29th verse. So Israel set men in ambush around about Gibeah, and the people of Israel went up against the Benjamites on the third day, and this is the time that they are tremendously victorious. They pull this trick move, and they are soundly defeated. The city goes up in ashes. It is probably leveled, which, by the way, makes an interesting discussion as how the city is rebuilt and why it becomes the city of Saul. Remember we said these are about these two cities, the first kings. Gibeah seems to be beyond repair, destroyed, not usable by God. And Bethlehem appears to be a city of some decadence, but it has some redeeming features, as we'll see in Ruth. I want to go on right now then to the 21st chapter. Those, by the way, who escaped to Benjamin, I should go back to verse 46 of the 20th chapter. All who fell that day of Benjamin were 25,000 men that drew the sword, all of them men of valor. So they were brave warriors. They may have had other weaknesses. They certainly did, many of them. But the question always arises, were all of them bad? Does everybody have to die for the sin of a few? And I think God would say, no. Those who are guilty will be punished. But the 600 men turned, 600 of the Benjamites, turned and fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon. So the area which is just over the Arabah, that is, if I point to the map,
You'll have to believe me. It's up there just over.
It's still in the high country, but it's in a remote, rocky area. The men of Israel are at this time probably thoroughly exhausted, and some of them, I hope, are very repentive. And so, in essence, these 600 are allowed to live. But then the people of Israel, in verse 5, said, which of all of the tribes of Israel did not come up to the assembly of the Lord? Because we've got a problem. This tribe is going to die out if they don't have some women. And they very kindly look around, and somebody didn't come up to Mizpah. And the people of Israel had compassion for Benjamin. This is wonderful. It's a little late, but they now have compassion. There's 600 who are left. They butchered all the rest. And so they say, well, in verse 8, what one of the tribes of Israel did not come up to the Lord at Mizpah to murder all these guys? And they found out that Jabesh Gilead didn't. As you go across the Jordan, Jabesh in Gilead did not come up. And so the solution's wonderful. Well, there, we've got it made. All we have to do is kill everybody in Jabesh Gilead. Kill the women. Kill a man, kill the children, kill the animals, but we'll leave 400 virgins alive. Isn't that a good solution? You see, when you make a foolish vow, you're really in deep water. Instead of getting down on their knees and crying and weeping and saying, Lord, can you give us a solution to this dilemma? They come up with a nifty one. But the next one they come up with is, I think, even worse. We're short 200 women. What do we do? Oh, I know. Those young virgins who are dedicated to God, we'll go and kidnap them. We'll go to Shiloh, and when they come out to dance and praise God as Miriam did, when the Alamoth, the female choir comes out to praise and thank God, we'll kidnap them. Oh, what a good solution. Those who have been dedicated to God, we're going to kidnap those girls. As I say, nobody comes out of this smelling very good. It's a horrible situation. And yet, the next two judges who judge Israel, Deborah and Ehud, come out of Benjamin. Thank God that they saved the 600. Now, we have, 2 minutes for Ruth?
7 minutes.
7 minutes. 7 minutes, Ruth. This is called 7 minutes, Ruth. As I have suggested rather blasphemously, I think this was written by Ruth. The idea that, again, Samuel or somebody else has to write about Ruth. These are her personal experiences. It may be that Naomi also helped in the writing, but we for some reason we have the idea that only men could write. Where did we get that idea? At any rate, that's my suggestion. By the way, the Jews read this on Sivot. They read this at what we would call Pentecost. They consider this to be, and I think they're right, an inspirational book was, and it took place at that time of the year. wonderful custom, I think. Ruth herself means friend. And I just love that concept. There is a friend that's closer than a brother, says the writer of Proverbs. And Jesus says, I'm paraphrasing, but it's almost exactly what he says. I will give up my life for my friends. And he did. Again, in the days when the judges ruled, and you'll notice in all these postscripts, it never says who the judge is. This particular time period is almost impossible to decipher. I think it's somewhere in the peaceful period of Gideon, is my best guess, and that's all it is. The chronology is just impossible to figure out. The importance is that it takes place in the city of David. We know the story starts out as an absolute tragedy. The family of Elimelech and Naomi are all dead within a few years. All dead. Everybody connected with them, I shouldn't say Naomi is dead. If somebody is correcting me on that, of course not. But the men are all dead. Essentially, the family is over. Finished. They remained in Moab, and there's been some criticism that they would go to Moab. I don't know that we're justified in that. The town of Bethlehem, the house of bread, doesn't have any bread at this time. They may have had other choices. Ted and I talked about that. There certainly was prayer. There certainly Boaz managed to survive and thrive, and many others. Perhaps it was a rash act. But Naomi had no choice in that, and certainly Ruth had none. And maybe the answer that Elimelech went into Moab was just simply that Ruth was the reason. Not known by Elimelech, not known by anybody, but Ruth was the answer. They, of course, both took Moabite-ish wives. The name of one was Orpha, and the name of the other was Ruth. And again, Orpha gets the bad reputation as she went back to her gods and her people. These young women had been married for 6 or 7 years. We don't know how long, but probably they were both barren. We're meant to see that this was the end of the house of Elimelech. They were barren. They couldn't bear. What did they have in without a husband, going to a strange land? I don't know that Orpha is terribly wrong. I do know that Ruth is absolutely amazing. I don't know how to say it in any other way. She had the faith of the other Gentile women in the line of the Lord Jesus Christ. She was just amazing. And so I think the beautiful passage there that everybody knows, even after they were weeping, where Ruth says, I will never forsake you. I don't care whether I have any children. In essence, she's saying, I don't care whether I have a husband. I will take care of you, Naomi, is exactly what she says. And again, this is really corny, and I'm embarrassment, but I just can't think of anything. Friends in need are friends indeed. I'm sorry to put that up, but Matt has asked me to say, what is practical about this? And it's true. When you are in need and a friend helps you, it is important in your life and their life, and it's... And that's what Ruth does. She's absolutely just superb. Just a couple of things I want to point out because we're very familiar with the story. And that is that she has already, in full faith, accepted the God of Israel, under whose wings, Boaz says, you have come to take refuge. And when she lays down on the floor, there's some speculation that there was some sex that night, and I absolutely reject that. I think what happened is very clear, that this very faithful man, who, by the way, has saved her from the young man who could molest her, has taken care of her, has respect for her and for Naomi, takes his skirt. Third chapter, verse 9, he says, "Who are you?" He wakes up startled. "And I'm Ruth, your maidservant. Spread your skirt over your maidservant." That is a phrase used by God to describe an engagement, a spousal. "I took you to be mine." When he took his skirt and covered her, he was saying, "Yes, I want you to be my wife." And what he says is absolutely inspirational as well. "Now, my daughter, do not fear, for I'll do what you ask. For all my fellow townsmen know that you are a woman of worth." Simply in the Hebrew, that says, "I know that you are a strong woman."